If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Jeff Stein can't be with us today, but we have plenty to talk about. We've got a great guest, David Shedd, former veteran intelligence officer, former deputy director of the Office of ODNI, Office Director of National Intelligence, former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he's going to share his pearls of wisdom on the war in Iran that's going on right now, and also talk about his new great book, The Great Heist, China's Epic Campaign to Steal America's Secrets. But Karen, let's just start out with the aforementioned war in Iran. Secretary Hegseth, the Secretary of War, said Wednesday morning, "We're just getting started," suggesting that this could go on for a while. I think most people are more focused not on how it starts or how it will be getting started, but how it's going to end. Your thoughts?
No, I think that's a really good way to introduce it. I mean, we know what it means to be in a forever war. We know what it means to go into a war without thinking through step 2, 3, 4, and 5. We've seen this before, and now all of a sudden we're seeing it again. And it is, and to make matters worse, I think the idea that there really is, we don't know, as you suggested, what the rationale is for this war. Is it about regime change? Is it about nuclear weapons and deterring their nuclear capacity and their ballistic missile capacity? What is it about? And they keep changing it day to day, moment to moment, official to official. And so what we know is, but we know something from that. We know that they didn't feel like they needed to come up with a statement about what it was about. And that really is some kind of a very disturbing piece of what's going on right now.
Right. Yeah. Look, there's obvious parallels, which we're going to talk to David Shedd, our guest, about, because he was actually at the National Security Council in charge of intelligence during the run-up to the war in Iraq. So he's got a good perspective on that. But so there are obvious parallels with our decision, disastrous decision in retrospect, to invade Iraq. But at least during the Bush years, the president and his administration felt they needed to make a case, and they needed to go to Congress and to lay out why we had to invade Iraq. Now, of course, their reasoning turned out to be completely fallacious and based on false intelligence, misreading of intelligence, and all the consequences of that. But in this instance, it's not. I mean, leave aside going to Congress asking, as Bush did, for a congressional authorization to invade another country. They haven't, look, Trump hasn't even given a national speech to the country. Here's why we need to do this. The explanations keep changing. You know, Rubio says one day it's because of Israel and they were going to attack and therefore we had to do something. And then that didn't sit well with anybody. And so they had to come up with, go back to the imminence threat, mm-hmm. that there was an imminent threat. And I wrote on Spy Talk this week. We're all talking about the parallels with Bush, but it was President Obama and his drone campaign that opened the door wide open for a redefinition of imminence. And as I wrote about this week, there was a Justice Department white paper explaining the reasons for our drone strikes to kill suspected Al-Qaeda operatives, including one, Alaki, who was an American citizen. And in that, in their legal memo on this, they said that there was a broader concept of imminence that justified taking out somebody like Alaki. It didn't mean, and imminence didn't mean what the dictionary says it means, happening soon, underway, something about to happen. It can mean sometime in the future, because based on the pattern of activities of this individual, there's reason to believe he might be up to no good. And once you opened that door, you know, you created a loophole that you could drive a couple of nuclear aircraft carriers through, which Trump has just done, because
wait. But yeah, first of all, we don't know that they wouldn't have done that with or without the imminent, the change in the word imminence under the Obama administration.
No, but it gave them cover to do.
But have they used it as cover? I haven't seen. Have they?
Well, they keep saying, yeah, when the Rubio explanation didn't fly, they went back to Iran was an imminent threat, ballistic missiles, and rebuilding their nuclear program. Now, ballistic missiles, we should point out that the Defense Intelligence Agency did a report last year that said they're not going to have an intercontinental ballistic missile until 2036. So over a decade away. Does that fit into the definition of imminent to you? The nuclear program, we supposedly obliterated it, but now they were rebuilding it. We don't know how much, how close they are, where they are, whatever, but we're going to call it imminent. And, you know, the elastic definitions of imminence give presidents enormous latitude to basically do whatever they want.
Yes. And I think the elastic definitions of any of these terms that are associated with how we conduct war, which have been abused for this entire century since the attacks of 9/11, have been one of the real problems. And something I write about in Subtle Tools. And I think it's part of a bigger picture of how we use language to render it in many ways meaningless, which again, makes it also, iffy in terms of the law, because the law is meant to be very specific.
Right, right. You want to tell us what subtle tools are?
Subtle tools are what I call those tactics and strategies that are used that are not about the policy itself, but the way the policies are brought about and enacted. What are the actual mechanisms that are going on? And one of them is vagueness, intentional vagueness in crafting policy and law so that you can do basically whatever it is you want to do in a very broad way that is, so it's not about the aim of what you're doing. It's about the way you go about it, which is, then those tools still remain.
I was trying to give you an opening to talk about your book.
Well, that is what my book is about.
Well, but and the title of the book?
Oh, the title of the book is Subtle Tools: The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. Right. And it goes through a series of what I call subtle tools that are not overt policy decisions on the table, but the mechanism and strategies by which these policies are passed and enacted, which are tools that still lay on the table even after the acts themselves have become irrelevant, ceased, or been, you know, reformed.
Well, we are going to talk today about a book that has nothing, that is not about subtle tools. It's about the most unsubtle tools one can imagine. And that's the way the Chinese are stealing our secrets. David Shedd, co-author with Andrew Badger, is of The Great Heist, China's Epic Campaign to Steal America's Secrets. David is a veteran intelligence officer. He's with the CIA for two decades as an operations officer. Then he was a deputy director of Office of Director of National Intelligence. He was Director of Intelligence of the National Security Council during the run-up to the war in Iraq, and he was later Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So he's got plenty to say about all these subjects. So let's get right to it.
Do your knees make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility, and your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals, just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear knee sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's gonna give out, let it be him, not your knees.
David Shedd, welcome to Spy Talk.
It's my kind of language, Michael.
Yes. Veteran intelligence officer at all levels on multiple continents. We definitely want to talk about your fascinating new book, The Great Heist, about China. But we are at war right now with the government of Iran. And obviously, this has raised a lot of questions about where this is going, what our justification for doing it is. Give us your top-of-the-line thoughts on what you're seeing about this war in Iran right now.
Well, this is a high-wire act in terms of going in on Saturday and decapitating the leadership, including Ayatollah Khamenei, and the rest of the leadership, 49, I believe, is the number that's out there. In joint Israeli and U.S. Air campaign in terms of hitting these targets. The High-Wired Act is, it is historically proven that there is no war that's ever been won from the air, and leading to the destruction of the ballistic missile sites and additional targets related to the nuclear file in Iran is probably very much in keeping with the targeting packages that are being hit. The idea that somehow it will bring about regime change is very much in question, in my view, after 47 years of the Iranian Revolution and subsequent to 1979, and having them come to power, as we saw the U.S. embassy hostages taken and all of that in 1979, and see it where it is today. The three observations: the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and all those associated with the security apparatus, the Ministry of Intelligence and Security, the MOIS, and others will not go down without a fight, no matter what takes place, because it's really the preservation of an ideological, religious-driven motivation in terms of holding on to power. Second observation is in the 90 million in population of Iran, you're talking about the vast majority are unarmed and incapable, as we saw with the protests in January. My estimate is, with many others, well over 30,000 killed in the streets of various cities of Iran in terms of the protesters. Having them go to the streets again under these conditions might very well lead to the same kind of outcome. And my third observation is I don't know what winning looks like at this point. And I raise the question of when you start something, as we well know, it has permutations. And I go back to a very different situation, very different circumstances, perhaps. But it was by October 2003, you had the Sons of Iraq in, out in Anbar province and elsewhere, rising up as a Sunni counter revolution in Iraq after the invasion of March 2003. And as I sat at the NSC staff in the White House of George W. Bush, it was very clear we were on the cusp of potentially losing Iraq in that October 2003 timeframe. Totally unforeseen in terms of we weren't greeted with the Rumsfeldian view of rose petals and welcoming songs and all the rest in the streets of Baghdad and elsewhere. Again, different circumstance, I understand. I'm not drawing a one-for-one parallel. But the point is that war has consequences that, on balance, have more unseen consequences than foreseen outcomes. And so where does this end up? I have no doubt there will be fewer ballistic missiles, there will be fewer, the nuclear sites will be further degraded. Doesn't mean if they've taken the highly enriched uranium at 60% and hidden it, that you've been able to find it. And I don't think the regime falls as a result of this, absent major defections and certainly people going out to the streets again, but against a very heavily armed counter response by the regime.
So let me just ask you, because, you know, the goals of this war are a bit unclear at this point. You just said I don't know what winning looks like, but it does seem at this point that anything short of regime change is not going to do it, that that's really what they're after here. And is there any way to achieve regime change without boots on the ground, troops inside Iran?
Well, to say anyway, the only way, absent boots on the ground, of which I don't think that's being seriously considered, and like all of you, it's very hard to tell what are psyops in terms of the psychological operational messages that are out there in terms of the threat of it and not discounting it and all of that, as Secretary Hegseth has said. Is that you either have to have major defections from within the power structure that currently exists, and now it's the son of Khamenei that has presumably taken over the reins of power in terms of supreme leader, along with, I think, a three-person council around him, is without those defections and without a public uprising that is effective in going against the regime, I don't think there's regime change. I think now it's degraded from the standpoint of what it might be able to do with ballistic missiles as it's used up its arsenal of them and that sort of thing. I'm not denying that clearly there's damage done to the, there will be no Navy for Iran for a while. I mean, it's clearly degraded in that way. Although I do think that when it comes to unmanned vehicles in terms of drones and that, of which they're very advanced, I think they probably have thousands to use. And we've seen them using it against some of our own facilities in Bahrain and the consulate and so forth. So I don't know where the uncle moment comes. I've had enough. Let's talk. And what does the administration think is enough to bring them back to the table to do this? So that's the part that remains as an open question.
I have a question. One of the things you write about in your book, which we're going to get to, is the sort of unbelievable naivete of American elites, including people in the American government. And we can talk about that later in terms of your book. But, you know, we all saw the video of all the intelligence that was shared and the targeting of the compound that the leadership of Iran was in and how that went according to plan and with so much preparation. But what about the people that really understand Iran culturally, politically, that you know, I've noticed that a lot of the people that were advising about Iran, you know, all over the U.S. government are now no longer in government. Do you think that we have in place the expertise we need to understand what is going on the ground, so to speak, in Iran?
That's been a challenge well beyond Iran in terms of expertise that has either left government service or isn't sort of in the first ring of influencers within the government as well. In other words, there are those who are ideologically driven to do what is being done, and then there are those who pragmatically look to close a deal. But in both instances, those type of people oftentimes do not understand the culture, the background, the history associated with it. I mean, I would be hard-pressed to find administration officials that could take you back to 1953 and how the Shah came to power, what the motivations were for the revolution in part in 1979 with Death to America and British Petroleum. It's intelligence is an interesting craft in that it brings expertise, but oftentimes it brings the expertise that, as you suggest, Karen, isn't often welcome or at times not welcome because of the news that it delivers, that this is going to be hard. This regime will fight back. It's going to die because they're in an infinite game, which is, of course, a religious fervor that's behind the Shia sect of Islam. And to have that all kind of a delivered up and say, well, Mr. President, this isn't a sure thing, and certainly not with an air campaign. So defining what your objectives are and defining the reasons as to why you went in really do matter. And they can't be shifting if you want a solid message to get the American people, both through our representatives, but then the American public more generally, to be behind this effort. And I think that shows up in the polling because it's unclear where this is headed, notwithstanding that the objective in a lofty sense is you know, bring freedom to the Iranian people. Of course, that everyone would want that. But the question is how and what are the expectations against that expertise? And I'm not sure that expertise is always in the room. I'll leave it at that.
So, David, you've had quite a career in the intelligence community. You were CIA operations for nearly two decades. Then you were at the National Security Council during the entire early years of the Bush administration, and you were there for 9/11, but you were there for the war in Iraq and all the intelligence mishaps that occurred during that run-up period. You had a catbird seat for all that, and I just wonder, to what extent do you see parallels with that experience with Iran right now? And, you know, what are the similarities? What are the differences that you see?
Let me start with the differences. And I remember a conversation with a great clarity of what Vice President Cheney and Secretary Rumsfeld and others who were kind of in that grouping recommended, which was the entire debathification, which, to explain to the audience, was, of course, where Saddam Hussein, Qusay and Nusay, his two sons, and the rest of the Sunni minority of Iraq ruled from, and that clearing that out was the best thing for Iraq. And what it turned out to be was it created an enormous power vacuum that resulted in the Sons of Iraq arising, as I mentioned earlier, by October, six, seven months after March, the March invasion of 2003. So in contrast, the decapitation and then the occupation is clearly a difference to date as it pertains to Iran. The decapitation of what now is in Iran is that the succession piece is clearly there in place, not to suggest that with the Azeri significant percentage of Iran's population in that it's totally homogeneous is that certainly within the power structures of the clerics and the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and the other power structures of security, is they had a de facto succession plan. I mean, they are now replacing those, and we're not there in terms of that. So that's another difference. The problem now becomes is what follows. As I said earlier, that is an open question, because I don't think there is any way that the Iranian regime will not go down fighting and fighting to the brutal death, if that's necessary. We saw them in a long war with Iraq itself in the 1990s and the period there, where chemical weapons were used and all that sort of thing, and they did not they weren't vanquished as a regime. So they have a tolerance for pain. They have a tolerance for certainly countering outside interference, as you might call it. And there is no opposition to work with inside Iran. And so this puts the administration currently in a really, really tough spot in terms of what does change in Iran really mean, if it is about regime change. That remains the open question. But absent physical presence by U.S. and international forces, or whatever it is, external forces, it's not likely to happen, absent, again, major defections and a view that there is an alternative for the Iranian people that don't support the regime.
Of course, the administration's messaging on this has been muddled, to say the least. Secretary Rubio, when he gave that explanation that, well, we had to go in because the Israelis were going to go in, and therefore Iranians would attack us, and therefore we had to, did not play well, not just with the MAGA base, but even, you know, people who might have been otherwise sympathetic. But the idea that we were forced by the Israelis to go in was not good for messaging. So now they've circled back with the original justification, imminent threat. Now, exactly what the imminent threat seems a bit malleable, whether it's ballistic missiles or rebuilding the nuclear program, all of which seems exceedingly tenuous. But, you know, imminent threat was also the argument that the Bush people were using for going into Iraq. So there seems to be a parallel. But in terms of imminent threat, when you look at it, a lot of people see we're stretching the word imminent into ways that go well beyond what the dictionary says imminent means.
Well, and Michael, I would place the invasion of Iraq and the faulty intelligence, which I was a part of being briefed into, as opposed to dissecting it or collecting it at that point in my career, because I'm sitting as an intelligence policy person at the White House in 2003 or late 2002, in the lead up that led to it, is along with 9/11, two of the largest intelligence failures that I certainly experienced in my 30-plus year career. And now the word imminent, and which has often been used in the context of counterterrorism operations, i.e., that is an individual or a unit or an element that's about to attack the United States, ergo, you remove them through kinetic action, or you somehow are able to detain them, or have a friendly service go after them in terms of that imminent threat. It's because there was a concrete plan of an attack on a certainly periodicity that the three of us would understand to be imminent, which would be, you know, in the next days, a few days, a week to 2 weeks. I mean, not years. I mean, and so it's interesting how the story has, in terms of making their case, has in fact changed a bit, and they have circled back to the imminent threat versus the Israelis were going to do it, and therefore I heard Secretary Rubio's comments to that yesterday, and whatever he said today, I haven't got the latest one in terms of the twist around the
it does seem to change. Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we're going to come back, we're going to talk about David's new book, The Great Heist, about Chinese espionage. And we're going to start out with a big question for him that I think a lot of people who study and follow China are asking right now. So we'll be right back. And we are back with David Shedd, former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, veteran intelligence officer, and co-author of the new book, The Great Heist, China's Epic Campaign to Steal America's Secrets. So the big question I have for you, David Shedd, on all this is you point out in the book that the 2023 annual threat assessment of the U.S. intelligence community concluded that President Xi has ordered the People's Liberation Army to develop the capabilities to invade Taiwan by 2027. That's next year. Does our attack on Iran, which follows, of course, our attack on Venezuela, does it make it easier and more likely that President Xi will, in fact, invade Taiwan?
My strong sense is that President Xi has learned a lot of lessons, or continues to learn a lot of lessons, both from Ukraine and now watching Iran, in terms of the U.S. response or offensive actions in the case of Iran, in the sense that he is, while the People's Liberation Army modernization continues to take hold through, in part, the heist, and we can get into some of the details as to that modernization being built off of what they have been able to steal from our industrial base here, is that the likelihood of going into Taiwan, the 110 miles across from Fujian province in China, is really measured against the capabilities of what the adversary, in this case Taiwan for mainland China, for Beijing, really have, and their ability to fight back. And I think that, as you well know, there has been a purge taking place at the highest levels, with General Zhang being the most recent casualty of that purge. Yeah. On the basis of allegedly sharing nuclear secrets. And of course, you always throw in corruption just in case there's nothing else that you can put up.
Sharing nuclear secrets with who? Who is
with he? With the United States. That was one of the rumors that, of course, which is a very, very humiliating attack on a kindergarten partner of Xi's, and his father, who was both fathers were Long March veterans, and all of that. That you would attack your number one political competitor the way did General Zhang with that with that attack of being a spy in helping the United States better understand the nuclear capabilities of China. I digress. Really, on the whole question of more likely or less likely, I think that Xi is taking a pause to better understand what he is up against. And I think he is a keen observer of both what has been occurring for the last 4 years in Ukraine/Russia, and then by extension now the Iran. Do we call it a campaign? Whatever, the undertakings that are now in kinetic actions in Iran, in terms of the capabilities of Iran to respond to that.
War seems like a good word to use.
Yeah, right. So I think it's a 50-50 in terms of 2027 in going forward on that. But I would have to have inside information as to what lessons he's actually taking away. But he is a keen observer of them.
I should point out, since we were just discussing before the break, the use of the word imminent, but you wrote in the book pointing out that in June 2025, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth called the Chinese threat to Taiwan imminent. So yeah. Once again, use of that word, but you said it's 50-50, you'll do it next year in 2027. What about going forward 2028, the rest of the decade?
Oh, I think that Xi has made it part of his permanent legacy to bring Taiwan into the fold. He's obviously used very, very different tactics in Hong Kong with the national security law and tightening the noose around that. And you see in Jimmy Lai and others who are, of course, held hostage to that tightening noose from Beijing and Hong Kong. I don't think that's the likely scenario for something as complex and big and important as Taiwan. I think that in the end, Taiwan will fight back very, very hard. It's nationalistic in its own right, going back to, of course, the remnants from the escaped aspects of the Long March when Mao rode into Peking at the time. And so I think this will be a real war. Now, it may take on different dimensions in terms of initially cordoning it off in terms of access to the outside world and that sort of thing in hopes that it doesn't require an invasion. But I think an invasion is likely certainly by the end of the decade.
And last question on this, and then I'll let Karen dig into some of the details in the book. But the fact that under this administration, we have been so aggressive in attacking other countries, kidnapping the leader of Venezuela and taking him back to stand trial, killing the leader of Iran. Does it make it harder for us and perhaps the world to condemn and resist a Chinese attack on Taiwan when we are attacking countries left and right?
My fear is that the fact of the Trump doctrine is starting to carve up the world in a manner that it's solely, if not primarily, defined as U.S. interests, according to the White House, and I'm talking about the power structure that's in place here, that you kind of go for a settlement having to do with Russia and Ukraine. That is, the Donbass or a good portion of the Donbass is given to Russia. That's the settlement. Why? Because that's the sphere of influence of Vladimir Putin and the Russians. And then in that case, Beijing, as it pertains to Taipei and Taiwan, is that's in their sphere of influence. And I think there is this Monroe Doctrine that's applying now to the Western Hemisphere, called the Donro Doctrine. I think that Cuba is probably in now, I'll use the word imminent, soon to be a country that additional pressure will fall on it, as well as to Nicaragua and the Ortegas there. That I think that it makes it more likely for Xi Jinping and the CCP and the PLA to read a message that that's in their sphere of influence in the United States will not intervene in the case of Taiwan. I'm suggesting how they would be seeing it. And that's why my eyes are absolutely fixated on this state visit, should it go forward, as I suspect it will, between Trump and going to Beijing next month. And what does that conversation look like?
Explain, what do you think is going to take place at that summit that might affect this?
I'll give you first my fear and then what I wish it would be. My fear is that it'll be highly tactical. It'll be, again, talking about precursor chemicals for fentanyl, which is a broken record in terms of what the Chinese can and should be able to do in terms of stopping precursor chemicals for fentanyl and other aspects of that. Secondly, a message about the sphere of influence for us is the Western Hemisphere, the United States, that is. And you need to understand that that's where we're going to push back on. But, you know, the rest of the world, we can find accommodations for it. In terms of Beijing's interests, and why can't we just get along and sort of meet in the middle? Beijing, and the book brings this out, has no interest in meeting in the middle. I mean, it has a view of the world in which they're coming out of their century of humiliation with a great leap forward, that after joining the WTO in 2001, they are very much fixated on overcoming the United States in terms of its national interests in what it would determine to be a near peer, actual peer, and beyond peer competitor, adversary to the United States in the long term.
Karen?
Yeah, I think maybe we should turn to your book in the time we have remaining. First of all, I want to tell you, it's a terrific read for something that's so technology, you know, savvy and so complicated in terms of all the things you have to know to master this field. You made it very readable for actual people who aren't. So, thank you. And it's basically about the technological arms race between the United States and China, and how China has vastly won this war, and they've done so by stealing the intellectual property and data of American companies, etc. So, I mean, that's kind of the overview of the book. But there's a line that goes through the book, is that how did this happen, right? And so there are a variety of factors in how this happened, and you explain them very well. But one of them is just this profound naivete on the part of both business, and I think it's really interesting the way you talk about Elon Musk in the book, and on some of the most pivotal people in the American government, starting with perhaps Bill Clinton. And I just wanted you to talk about why this naivete was able to persist so long, basically through 2025, as you describe it. And were there moments that you saw where that should have taken a turn that it didn't take, and there were people saying, "Come on, you got to pay attention to this in better ways," or not?
The naivete really begins with the grand opening of China in 1972 and Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
But then you fast forward to our ability to ignore a seminal speech given by Deng Xiaoping in June of 1984, 5 years before Tiananmen occurs, to a Japanese audience in Beijing, in which he says there will be a coexistence going forward of a single party state, the Chinese Communist Party, of course, being the single party, and then with Chinese managed capitalism. In the Mandarin that I never learned, it has been explained to me in very flowery terms, this was centrally managed capitalism, Chinese style, that within certain guardrails, capitalism would flourish. And that, in fact, the Guanxi, which is this relational aspect of Chinese owing one another and owing the state a certain benefactor relationship, really kicked off in the 90s. And so it really goes a little further back than the Clinton administration in the 80s with George Herbert Walker Bush and Brent Scowcroft, when he makes his secret trips that I lay out in the book to Beijing, including right in the aftermath of what had occurred at Tiananmen in June of 1989, and really kind of overlooking it. Why? Because there was a grand strategy to bring China into what formerly was the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, to now the World Trade Organization. That occurs in a bipartisan way under George W. Bush in December of 2001. My operations in the mid-1990s come to a screeching halt and captured in the foreshadowings in the book, really with this naivete that really centered around two things, and it was bipartisan, and it was widespread. It was in corporate, it was in government, it was on Main Street, and it was certainly on Wall Street. And it was that if China joined the WTO, they would play by the international rules. The rules of trade, the international finance, Think of Bretton Woods, think of IMF, think of all the sort of the rules put in place in the World War II, post-World War II, and all of that. And they would play by those rules. Nothing could be further from the truth. And that's what this grand larceny of our intellectual property brings out. Once they received the most favored nation status, removal of that constraint, they dump enormous amount of consumer goods in the U.S., even though in the 1990s, when I was going there regularly and serving there perhaps for a while, you were seeing these knockoff piracy products all over the place on the sidewalks and everywhere, low tech and all of that. The naivete continues, though, as we go on the offense on the war on terror after 9/11 2001, and whether it was Hu Jintao or Zhang Zemin, and then really Xi Jinping puts it, he turbocharges it in 2012, 2013, when he comes to power and he launches Made in China 2025 in 2015. So 10 years ago now, 11 years ago. And now it's been extended to 2030, in which he is intent on overcoming the United States in these key technology areas, Karen, that you point out that the book addresses in terms of intellectual property that Chris Wray, the former director of FBI, put at $600 billion or more a year in value. So 2/3 of our defense budget, for example, just to put it in context. Doubling the size of the Ministry of State Security, which in China is the CIA, the FBI, Cyber Command, NSA, and any intelligence, to more than 300,000 operatives now that are working this, and they're working those typhoon attacks that we hear about, Salt Typhoon, Volt Typhoon, which I'm happy to elaborate on. The naivete, though, continues. All the while, China's economy becomes interlaced, integrated into the U.S. economy. We saw fissures of that in the supply chains during COVID. It shined a particular light on the supply chain pieces, whether it came out of Mexico and the supply chains that were coming into the U.S., not just in medical supplies, but elsewhere. It kind of really brought home how little control we still had on our supply chains, on these critical, incritical areas like that. And so you had this integrated economy in which there was generally this desire over and over to make this work. Somehow the integration, which would never have occurred with the Soviet Union, now occurred with China for now 40 years. It really takes hold and it becomes integral to how the U.S. economy operates, and vice versa, the dependency that China has on markets in the United States for their products, goods, and services. And so that's part of it. Then there's the grand opening to China, to U.S. investment, Western investment in China under joint ventures. Now, Elon Musk is interesting because he got an exception. He got full ownership for Tesla, groundbreaking in Shanghai for the Gigafactory in 2019, all the while $1 billion in source code is taken by Mr. Cao and prosecuted against and all of that. And so,
explain that a little bit. Can you? What was the case?
It's the industrial book opener. It's the hook that tells you the story of where Elon Musk in the summer of 2018 inks the deals for Tesla to go to China. In his state of mind, Elon Musk says, "I'm always going to stay ahead of a BYD or any other competition in the EV market, electric vehicle market." All the while, back at Tesla headquarters, in a very restricted access area, a Chinese American, Mr. Cao, downloads and uploads then the autopilot portion of all that software that now is in all the BYDs and other Chinese-made electric vehicles. The point is that China had a very intentional plan to move into the EV market and dominate it, and now does. If you look at where Tesla is versus BYD in Europe and Latin America and Africa, and it far exceeds what the sales are for Tesla. And I think in many ways, Elon Musk has moved on, and it's really dominated now by the Chinese. That captures the fact that the Chinese, while you're working in good faith with them, and I'm going to say that Elon Musk was working in good faith to access a 1.4 billion person market in China and all of that with Tesla, all the while his pocket is being picked. Or his computer is being downloaded, or whatever form you want to. And there are multiple stories of Google having this happen to it. Apple has it happen to them for their driverless cars, and on and on. Huawei does it in terms of the microchips and other things. And so the stories that the book captures is this arc of a campaign as opposed to one-offs that we read about almost on a daily basis of what China does in terms of capturing our intellectual property. And for the viewership or the listenership, we're really talking about the blueprints. It's the research and development. It's the ability for them to bypass the cost associated with that. It's not that the Chinese workers aren't hard workers and all the rest. They just don't pay the initial cost associated with it. And they leapfrog all that at our expense and then are where they are today. Just to give everyone a sense of magnitude, in 2001, China's economy was $1.3 trillion in nominal GDP. In same dollar GDPs in 2020, in 2024, are basically at 19 trillion. And the argument is they could not have made that growth without this heist of this intellectual property, not only in the United States, but the West more generally. And we naively allowed it to happen.
Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting because on a much lower level and a much different thing, don't you see this or do you see this as sort of they understood something you try to wish we understood better, which is that national security is economic security and that we do not understand that that's the base of our naivete. And so I'm wondering, do you also see their Belt and Road Initiative as a different entry into the same attempt to own the access to production, the access to workers, et cetera, or would you consider them completely separate?
No, I think they do. They overlap much like a Venn diagram in the sense that Belt and Road kicked off in 2012 by Xi and the CCP is really their soft power. And so they'll go in with loans that they never expect to have repaid. But now they have the leverage. So it's a deep sea water port in Peru. It's the same in Uruguay. I know the Latin America infrastructure pretty well. 20 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean have Belt and Road
and Africa
relationships with China. And this is overt. This is where they simply, it's the exposure of their loans in Belt and Road in Venezuela, which they may now have a really hard time getting back. But it's this idea that it's complementary in terms of what the MSS, the Ministry of State Security, and the Great Heist is about. It's not a one for one. I mean, obviously they bring in their workers, they do the mining in Belt and Road in the African countries for rare earth minerals. They do these infrastructure projects all throughout Latin America, building the subway for Bogota under Belt and Road, all those sorts of things. They then apply technologies for their companies because as the national security or the national intelligence law of 2017, Article 7 requires is that every Chinese citizen at home and abroad, as well as any Chinese entity, must cooperate with the CCP. In that way, there is an overlap. They clearly have a vested interest and influence in these countries, and any tool that allows them to have greater influence is to their benefit.
So given the fact that there's part of that naivete, or a large part of it, is this refusal to see the, you know, great power competition, you know, outside of the military sphere, but all, you know, in the economic sphere, to, that we need to, do we need to do something government-wise? Do we, can business handle some of this lack of attention? Where do you, what needs to change for this to be addressed in a way that makes sense for the moment?
It's really interesting. I taught for 8 years at a college level and as an adjunct, and I can tell you one thing that I was impressed by was President Truman, 1947, had the ability to foresee the role of the United States in global affairs after World War II, and the National Security Act is passed. And in that National Security Act is part of what I served in the NSC and CIA went from being the OSS. And so now you have a national intelligence capability, a centralized intelligence capability, and all of that as a result of that. My argument is this economic warfare that you suggested here, Karen, is the economic warfare requires a change of paradigm on the part of the United States. And it's the creation of a national economic security apparatus. But this one would be different. This one required having private sector as well as academia tied into it. And then you say to yourself, what crown jewels do we want to protect at all costs? Not everything is decoupled from China, but what is it that we cannot afford from a national security standpoint? And this is why I'm very concerned about H200 chips going to China from NVIDIA. They'll reverse engineer it. That's what they do. There is no assurance that this they won't have the capability to take those and apply them to AI, advanced AI models well beyond DeepSeek in terms of their version of ChatGPT or whatever these other models are. And so in the AI race, why would we give them those sorts of things, or why would we not protect those things that we must protect? And that's what this council would really be focused in on. So that would be the infrastructure part, but it comes in tandem with really raising the bar on, at all costs, U.S. investment cannot go into these crown jewel areas in China, or vice versa. Chinese Shenzhen capital cannot come into the U.S. and invest in them and have a piece of the rock, so to speak. And so you really cordon off what are those things in biotech, in areas of microchip technology development that you really want cordoned off from their access to it.
You know, in Trump's first term, he had a National Security Council staffer, Matt Pottinger, who understood these issues and was quite, he was a hawk on China and really made efforts to ensure that our policy reflected the concerns you're raising here. It's not clear that there's anybody like him in the administration at a high level right now. And do you see that absence, and do you see that reflected in decisions like the NVIDIA chip one?
Absolutely. And a shout out for Matt Pottinger, who worked for me as well at one point.
Oh, really?
In his career. Yeah, dear, dear friend of mine. And consulted with the book, and he's clearly covered in the book as well because of his knowledge of being a correspondent in Beijing with Wall Street Journal and knows China inside and out. There is no voice like that in the administration. And what that has led to is an administration and a president in particular who is far more tactical. And he thinks everything is a transactional arrangement with China. China, in contrast, is seeing this as far more strategic in terms of its interests. So when there is that whole discussion of the rare earth minerals and the potential of China cutting us off on that 80%-ish of the supply that they control of rare earth minerals and magnets, there's no voice inside the administration that I know of that is outspoken on this issue to the point that it says, Mr. President, what you're seeing here is a hardball game played by China that essentially is graymailing us on, pick your topic, chips or anything else that we are engaging on transactionally.
The other explain thing I would that. Say, explain, Michael, one can other... you explain the gray mailing, what you mean by...
Well what I mean by that is...
Gray mail in this context?
The absence of, or the inability to have that supply until our reserves are up on rare earth minerals is a very, very serious problem for our auto production and many, many other high-tech fields that where these rare earth minerals are used. The gray mail comes in, and I think it's been laid out that China has given us 1 year of opportunities to get the rare earth minerals from them. The gray mail comes from, you know, in exchange, however, NVIDIA chips, or what else is it that they are using to leverage this control on rare earth minerals? And I'm not trying to be conspiratorial. I'm just thinking as an intelligence officer, what would it be that they have over us that shapes our policy responses to China? And it would be rare earth minerals and access to that for the foreseeable future. It's open press information about they have 80% of the supply chain. So, and we need them.
So last question, you said before you were concerned about the upcoming summit that Trump may have with Xi. What is it that, what's your worst case? What are you most worried about that could happen at that summit that will undercut U.S. national security?
The worst case is, and I'm not suggesting this will happen, is that there is a handshake on Taiwan, that in the name of preventing a war, there is an agreement that we will stop arms sales, that we will message very clearly that we will not go with Taiwan in the event of an invasion or some form of mainland takeover, whatever form that takes. That would be a worst case scenario. A next worst case is sort of walking away believing that China has come to an agreement on equivalent to the Obama Rose Garden on cyber attacks and all of that. And Trump walks away touting these great agreements with China, and they're laughing all the way. Of course, they're not going to comply. They'll have all kinds of alibis as to why they can't do it and all that, knowing full well under COVID, he could shut down mega cities and all the rest. So it's just not credible. But walking away, touting great successes when in fact there is no intent by China to comply with that. Meanwhile, agreeing not to do certain things against China in the classified world of cyber and all the rest, we keep our part of the bargain. They do not. That's a worst case and type of worst case scenario.
Right. Well, a sobering thought to close this out. But the book is The Great Heist, China's Epic Campaign to Steal America's Secrets. David Shedd, I want to thank you for a really interesting and important conversation.
Thank you for having me. And as I say, and Karen, rebound with you as well. Don't read the book after you don't have caffeine intake in the day, because you won't be able to sleep. It's so serious, and there aren't words to express how did we let this happen, and it continues to happen.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hockey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.